Hi, and welcome to Curious Conversations, the podcast where curiosity meets connection. Thanks for joining as we discuss captivating stories and ideas and engage in thought-provoking conversations with experts, enthusiasts, and everyday people. We hope to ignite a curious spirit as we embark on a quest for understanding one curious conversation at a time. So let's jump in this together. Welcome to the world of Curious Conversations. Hello and welcome to Curious Conversations. We are your hosts, Carly and Mandy. And this week, Mandy, I'm actually really excited about this. You had the opportunity to interview Terry Cox. Tell us how you know Terry.
Okay, so Terry is a fellow Rotter, and she's also in our Rotters group. And so, it just turns out that she has a lot of stories up her sleeve that I didn't even realize.
Yeah. I am learning that. She is an interesting person. Well, okay, so this time you were able to speak with her about a small town serial killer and kind of how that affected her. And that was back in the 70s, right?
Yeah, that was the Stocking Strangler of Columbus, Georgia. Yeah, so, and I wasn't even familiar with that whole story until she came to me.
Okay, well, I wasn't familiar with that story either. So she has enlightened us both. So we have that interview today. But before we do that, I think we jump into our curious dish. So this is the part of the show where we dish about the most curious thing that we have seen or experienced this week. So Mandy, you want to go first?
Okay. So, I did see something weird this week, a little unsettling and a little unnerving in a couple of ways. On social media, you have to, watch what you say. You have to watch your verbiage. You have to watch what you're sharing as far as posting. And, there's a lot of hoops to jump through and you hope might get out the other side.
Yep, absolutely.
So sometimes you see something and you think, so that passed. I'm not really sure how that one passed, but, we're learning. We're all learning. So I guess it's pictures of the deceased, mostly children and infants from a good while back, not current times, but when it was, they're wanting to do that in a tasteful way. They're wanting to have that memorial, that memory. And, I understand that for the family. It's not really wake up material when you pick up your phone and want to check the weather and what somebody has to say. But, it happens.
I cannot figure out how those algorithms work. You'll see somebody that gets blocked for nothing. Or I think the one that gets me every time is now you can't say killed. You have to say she was made unalived. Yeah. Little things like that. But then you see something that pops up that's a little shocking.
Well, these family members were unalived. Does that help? Are you clear on what happened there?
Got it. That should make it through. No problem.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, it's always funny. The comments are always more interesting than the post, right? So the back and forth and people are like, lovely. This is wonderful. Great job. We applaud you. Yeah. So come applaud me sometime. Right? That's all I'm asking. Equal opportunity.
That's right.
What do you have? Okay.
Well, mine is much lighter than that.
Good.
but a little strange, and I'm going to butcher my pronunciation. But I learned about something called the Mariko Aoki phenomenon. And I know I didn't say that right, but if anyone is fluent in Japanese, please feel free to reach out and help me with that. But that is
This is going to be weird, but did you know that 10% of people, when they visit a bookstore, the urge to poop?
The urge to poop with the books.
Yep. Yes. That's a real thing. Yeah. Right. And so I mean, I heard it. It was just a really quick statistic that was thrown out on another podcast. And I thought, we've got to look into that one. It was kind of interesting. They did a big study on it. And the study was inconclusive. You know, I don't have anything major that I can give you on what was found in that, but there were four kind of like, maybe this is it, maybe this is it kind of hypothesis that came about. One was, you know, seeing and smelling books reminded people kind of sitting on the toilet at home. You know, how many people have books in their bathroom and you just kind of flip through. And so, you know, maybe that was it. It kind of just jarred your memory of doing that at home. The second thought was bookstores are quiet and they're peaceful and kind of relaxing. And so people just relaxed.
Okay.
Totally relaxed. And even their bowels, you know, maybe that was it. The third one that I heard, which I thought, oh, now this might be a real thing. You know, a lot of people, when they're walking around a bookstore, they have a coffee in their hand. That's a stimulant. That's a real thing. So that could be it. And then the fourth one that honestly, the study seemed to lean more towards, but I felt like, well, that's kind of crazy. But it was a feeling of nervous tension from being in a bookstore with literary figures and just a wealth of information. They said that it could be intimidating, you know, which would kind of give you a nervous tummy. So,
oh my gosh. So these are not things I think about, but as you say that, I'm like, as soon as I hit like Barnes and Noble or somewhere like that, it's like probably the first thing I do is get a coffee. Yeah. And, you know, I do visit the restroom while I'm there. So much so that I made a post one time about, I really wish that the restroom's so nice at, you know, X bookstore that I wish they would put some hooks on the door for purses and such and bags, because there were literally no hooks. And I'm like, this is a nice place. Where are the hooks?
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, so see, you've experienced the phenomenon.
I've experienced it. And I will say, I'll add a fifth thing. They usually sort of set their customers up for a comfy top setting. So maybe people feel like they're at home.
Yes.
Yeah. They're just going to hop to the bathroom really quick.
That's it. You know, a lot of people can't unless they're at home. They need to be at home. So yeah. So
the bookstores help. They're there to
help. I like it. Yeah, that's right. I just don't want to work there as like their janitor.
Yeah. I'm thinking you take that little lot through and let's see what the books and the shelves look like. I don't want to know.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, getting on with the interview with Terry, I will say this before we play that interview. I think it's really neat that she approached me after hearing one of our previous episodes where we talked about writing pen pals for inmates and that sort of thing. That's what prompted Terry to approach us for an episode. She said, that made me think of this. You know, it made me think of a situation I was in that was, you know, we've talked before how we like to have something that's just not the information you get online, but what's relevant to us or what touches us in some way. And for Terry, you know, she lived in an area where there was a serial killer and there were killings going on around her, literally within blocks of her. And so that story to me is her personal, how that affected her personally, affects me personally.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's awesome. I can't wait to hear it. Every time I hear something from Terry, I like her a little bit more. She is just intriguing and has lived through so much. And she's open. She's an open book. She's so friendly. And so I'm excited. I think we just jump right in.
Sounds good. Hey there. I'm here with Terry Cox. And we're talking about something a little dark, well, a lot dark today, but I just always want to give that, I want to preface anything that I'm talking about for any of our listeners who may want a heads up. We are talking about Carlton Gary, who was a convicted serial killer in the 70s, and that was right here in Georgia. And we've got a personal take on that today. I'm speaking with Terry Cox. Thank you for being here, Terry.
Well, thank you for having me. Sometimes it's helpful to be able to talk about things that traumatized you, sort of therapeutic.
Absolutely. And as Carly and I have talked about before, we like to share stories that they're curious. Sometimes they're dark in nature, but they're not something you can just look up and get the information. We want to relate that to someone or something personal. And that's what this story does, because this was very personal to you, right?
Yes, it was. It very much so. It, you know, I say that a serial killer changed my life. Of course, you know, I feel that God is in control of my life. But this situation did make me go in a different direction. And, you know, I just think that's kind of interesting how just being in the town where it happened at the time can really change your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes things are not the most obvious connection, but there's certainly a connection there. And, you know, with us both being in Georgia, you know, here, I know that I guess I haven't heard of a lot of cases like this one in Georgia. I'm sure there's plenty of cases, but that's the thing. There's a lot of information out there, especially, you know, if you're searching. But when you came to me with this, you know, and how this connected to you in a personal way, I definitely thought that you were correct. It was a good fit for Curious Conversations. And we're just going to jump right in. For anyone who's listening who might not be, you know, familiar with this case and with Carlton Gary, he was known as the Stocking Strangler. And that was because of just what you expect, the way that he did kill his victims. He was a serial killer, and he was in Columbus, Georgia. That was during the late 70s. So it's my understanding, Terry, that he killed three women, and his target audience was older people or people who could not defend themselves as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. And actually, he was convicted of killing three women, but there were six women who actually died during that time. And we're all sure that, you know, he was the perpetrator of all six.
Well, that's what it looked like to me.
Yeah, they didn't bring up a case. You know, they look at what evidence they have and which ones are most likely for conviction, and they chose those. But there were six women who died in this particular, series. And there were some that survived, and he had killed in other places as well.
Yeah, I understand. Syracuse, New York, was where someone was killed, and you know, I did learn about the other people that they were, he was suspected of killing, but he was executed
right
in 2018, and right. So let's just get to the personal connection, and you just walk us through how this situation related to you and what your experience was.
Okay. Well, I graduated high school in 1977. And so I was getting ready to go to college. I had gotten a scholarship to Columbus College. And that's really my birthplace. That's my hometown. And we had moved away from there by that time. But I was getting a full scholarship there. I was so excited to be starting college. And at that time, Columbus College did not have dormitories for anyone except the athletes. So we arranged for me to move in with my grandmother, both sets of my grandparents lived in Columbus then. And my mother's mother, who I called Manny, she lived alone in an apartment complex in the Winton area of Columbus, which is where my mother was raised, in that same area. It was a little kind of a U-shaped apartment complex with a courtyard in the middle and a little bit of garden in the back. And so I was real excited about moving in with my nanny. You know, we were real close. And but right before I got down there, there had been a murder in her neighborhood, just a couple of blocks from where she lived. So we were a little concerned about that, but you know, I went ahead with my plans. The woman's name was Fern Jackson, and she was a well-known lady, you know, and several of these women were very well-known from prominent families in Columbus. But anyway, Miss Jackson had been murdered, and there had been another woman who had been attacked in a similar way, just as you mentioned, with strangled with stockings. And so I went on down to Columbus and moved in with my grandmother. And since I was sort of commuting from her home, I would, you know, be out on my own, coming and going from the college. And I was a music major, so I was out a lot at night and that sort of thing. So this was so stupid. And I think you'll relate to me, Mandy, because I know you wrote letters to a serial killer. But I was so curious about it. And not, you know, a day or two after I moved down there, I said, Nanny, I'm going for a walk. And I had the addresses of the victims. And so I just went for a walk, you know, a few blocks around from where she was, and I went to look at the houses where the incidents took place.
Oh yeah, I do relate.
That was so dumb, you know.
Yep.
When you're 18, you don't think about it. But anyway, so not long after that, I took some notes. September 25th, just a couple of weeks after I got there, was another murder. And this lady's name was Jean Diamondstein. And it was the same method, you know. So by then, everybody in town, I mean, that is all you talked about. And Columbus is a bigger city than where I live now in Cartersville, but it's still a small town atmosphere. Everybody was just traumatized by this. That's all you heard on the news, in the newspaper. You know, if you went out to the college or whatever, that's all anybody was talking about. You know, who was it? Who did it? Why would they do that to, you know, these were older ladies that lived by themselves. You know, who in the world would do anything like that? So,
yeah, that almost makes it more disturbing when you think, because one of the people that I wrote to, Richard Ramirez, you know, he had no, I mean, there wasn't a certain victim. It was anybody, and, you know, elderly and young people. And you think somehow that pushes it over the edge of being worse.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and one of the things that bothered me, of course, was that I was living with my single elderly grandmother.
Right.
So I was worried about her, and she was very independent. She would walk, you know, several blocks to the store, or, you know, she never did drive. But she would be out and about, you know, wasn't worried. And so now, you know, her life changed. She couldn't go out by herself. And all of the murders took place in the middle of the night. So, you know, in the daytime, of course, you were still thinking, you know, is this guy around here? Is he watching? You know, all those things went through your mind. And my uncle came over to the apartment. They had bars put on the windows. We just had a couple of windows. But we had a sliding glass door in the back. So we reinforced that. And he even brought us a gun, which I didn't grow up around guns. So, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I don't think my nanny did either, but she took it. And I think she kept it under her bed. But so then for me, because I would be going out at night, you know, by myself, he gave me a little case with a can of mace in it. And I carried that for my keychain. So every time I went out to my car, I had that can of mace in my hand.
Yeah, so it makes you look at your surroundings and be more aware.
Very much so. Very much so. So, you know, as it went on in October, just a few weeks later, another lady, Florence Scheibel, was murdered. The fourth victim was later on in October, Martha Thurman. She was 77 years old. And so around, you know, by that time, the fourth one, and they were coming like every 2 weeks, you know, just about the time you had gotten it into your head about one of the victims, here comes another one. And I remember when I was on campus, when I'd get out of class and you'd hear, oh, they just discovered another victim, you know.
Wow.
And I would be terrified because I wasn't at home. You know, did something happen while I was in class? Is my nanny okay? You know, and I would be frantic to find out the address or the name of the person. Because, I mean, I knew that probably didn't happen while I was in class. But anyway, I would still, you know, my gut would just be clenched until I found out, you know, what their name was.
So Terry, let me ask you, so you're not staying on campus. That's not available to you, but you're in the area. How these victims, these murders that took place, how close are you to those? I know you said you know, kind of did a walk through, but are they all in a close knit vicinity?
Yes, they were all within walking distance of our house. I mean, maybe the most was half a mile. They were all in the Winton area where she lived. And so, you know, we'd be looking out at night, looking in the bushes. I mean, and like if I got in my car to go to something on campus, people in the neighborhood sort of took it on themselves to be on the lookout. You'd see cars going by with like five men in them, you know, and you know what they were doing. They were patrolling the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, maybe deter anybody that might be lurking around.
Right.
So right about that time, after that fourth murder, we were all very concerned. My mother was concerned for her mother. So we made an arrangement for my nanny to leave town and go and stay at my mother's house in Calhoun for a while. You know, we didn't know how long. And my other grandparents lived across town. So I moved in with them to finish out, you know, my quarter or whatever. We were on the quarter system. So I think by December was when I moved to my other grandparents' house. And there was a murder in December, Kathleen Woodruff. And Woodruff was the name in Columbus, like, things in town were named after them. You know, they were a prominent family. And by that time, you know, rumors were flying, names were coming up. I mean, names of, you know, people you would never think of. There was one, they did determine that the man was African-American because of hair that was left behind at the scene. And, but there was another young man who was arrested, but he was cleared of it. But just, you know, just they were desperate to find, you know, who it would be.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. By February, on February the 12th, there was a woman who was attacked. And this woman, I guess her family was doing the same thing mine was. They had given her some kind of an alarm that they had installed in her bedroom. And he came in and started to assault her and she pressed her panic button. I guess an alarm went off or something.
Right.
And he left. He ran.
Oh my gosh.
So we heard that on the news, you know, the next day that he had attacked her, but she had survived, and everybody was glad, you know, like, yay, you know, 1 point for us. But then the terrible news came that as soon as he left her house, he went to another house and killed another lady that same night. And so that was actually I call it the sixth victim, although one of them has survived. So this is really where it comes to the place, other than that I was terrified, afraid to go anywhere at night. And I knew I wasn't the victim profile, but still everybody was terrified. And so we made the decision that I, at the end of that quarter, that I would leave. I just could not bear, you know, what was going on. It was just so awful.
So, yeah, that's really scary. I'm trying to put myself in that scenario because I've always been able to talk about things, at least from a distance. But, you know, this day and age when we have so much access to information, you know, you can do those searches and see what your neighborhood looks like, see who your neighbor is in many cases, you know, many situations where, you know, a legal issue or something like that. And you can make yourself a little bit nervous or paranoid these days when you think about we're all just sort of in a fishbowl and who are you with? But you knew that you were with, so to speak, somebody dangerous. And, you know, that makes sense to get out of there. But how did you feel about, I'm sure that was mixed emotions in leaving that path.
It really was. I mean, I loved Columbus. Like I said, it's my hometown where most of my family lives. And I hated to have to leave, but it just felt like a weight on you. You know, you had to always be on the lookout, and it was just terrifying. And I had joined my nanny's church, which was Winton Methodist Church. And so I'd go to choir practice on Wednesday night. I'd walk out my car, and I'm, you know, there might be people, there might not. But I remember one night walking out thinking, is he here? Is he looking around, you know, just going to my car? And this is the part that where I don't know, it had already affected me, but, you know, I had left and I just took a quarter off and looked at other colleges in the meantime. But in April of that year, I got the news. I guess, you know, we didn't have cell phones and stuff like that, you know.
Sure.
And when I went home, to Calhoun, they weren't covering the story. So when I found out that another victim had been killed, and it was a lady I knew, and she was a member of my church choir at Winton Methodist. Her name was Janet Cofer. She was a nice lady. I mean, you know, I wasn't best friends with her, but I did know her, you know. She was part of my church. And I thought, oh my goodness, had she just been to choir practice, they found her on a Thursday morning. I guess technically she was killed on Thursday, but, you know, had she been to church the night before? You know, was she in that same parking lot that I was in? Was he watching her? Did he follow her home? I mean, it almost felt like, you know, I was there with him, you know.
Yeah, it becomes very real at that point, even more so. And it's something that's relating then directly to you. And that's terrifying.
It was, even though I was gone, you know, I couldn't believe that he had killed somebody that I knew. And I remember the next time I was in Columbus, I remember going by her house, and I just parked in front of her house and stared at it. You know, I felt so bad for her and her family. And it was, you know, just terrifying. And And like I said at the beginning, you know, I know God guides my path, and I ended up going to Shorter College instead, which, excuse me, it was the perfect place for me, you know, and it was, I'm really happy that part ended up the way it did, but that was the last of the murders. And, mm-hmm. but the thing was, you don't know it's the last murder.
Right.
You know? They stopped at that point, but you don't know that for a long time, you know, you know, who knows how long it would be before you would feel safe again. And you may have looked up more information on maybe why it ended at that point. He went on, I mean, he didn't stop. He was a criminal before he committed all those murders. As you said, he had been up in New York for a time. He was from Columbus, but he had been in New York and some other places. But he did armed robberies after that. He was still committing crimes.
Yeah, I understand he escaped custody at one point.
He did. He was in jail, I think, for robbing restaurants. He was like the steakhouse robber or something. They had another name for him.
Oh, he had a secondary name?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was in custody. He escaped. And he was arrested in 1984. And it was a kind of a roundabout way that they caught him. After he stopped the murders, he committed some burglaries in the same area. And there was a gun that had gone missing from one of the homes. And that gun went around. I think a relative of his got it and committed another crime.
What?
With it. And they caught him and found the gun. And he had to, you know, they had to trace where the gun had come from. And it had come from Carlton Gary, who they knew was doing the murders at that time. And it was kind of a roundabout way that they figured out, you know, who he was.
Yeah, I knew it was indirect, you know, and that happens sometimes. I didn't know about that secondary name. And usually there's multiple names with someone who lives a criminal life. I had learned that there was supposedly an accident on a playground. I don't know if that was once he was I'm assuming when he was a child. And you know, I don't know if there was an injury, like a brain injury. I'm not stating that as fact, but when I looked into that, there were kind of some questions there. Cause I'm always curious about why people do what they do. I don't have any desire to hurt anybody. And so it's hard for me to relate, but I'm always trying to make that connection as another human being. Why in the world would they do this?
Yeah. And we all were thinking that. And I remember thinking you have to have a mother or a girlfriend or a brother, somebody who knows that you were out on all those nights, you know, that you were, you know, somebody should have picked up on it.
Yeah, that's always strange to me. That. Yeah, it's
you know,
weird.
How could nobody know that you were doing this? But you know, yes, I had heard that he had the accident. Like his mother, his father was absent or maybe deceased, and his mother couldn't take care of him, and he was with relatives. And I read somewhere that his mother or whoever was taking care of him worked for elderly white women.
Oh,
and that maybe he resented wealthy white women, you know, elder white women. That was one of the theories about him.
Now, I never heard that before, but that's interesting because, like I said, I always try to make some kind of connection, and maybe it's me trying to make some sense out of the crazy world, you know, in my head, why people do what they do. But, you know, sometimes there are those little connections, and still you think to yourself, well, okay, and that warrants this. And so I'm not excusing anything, but with somebody who has a fragile mind or who has some sort of distorted, you know, thought process, then they could take something like that. You know, who knows how he perceived different things in different situations to account for his, how he was driven toward this.
That made sense to me, you know, that might be what the connection was. If for some reason he felt that those, you know, whoever his family member worked for was not kind to them or demeaned them or something, and he was in some way trying to get back, you know, at them. I don't know.
Well, let me ask you, when you were doing, you know, you said you did a lot of like looking over your shoulder and I can imagine so. And then you walked around to some of these places that maybe you shouldn't have went, but you're curious, did you see anything suspicious, any clues, anything, or you just were sort of just checking out the scene?
No, I never did. But, you know, my nanny, she was a feisty lady. She was really great. And, they put out a reward for, you know, information leading to his capture. And I want to say, you know, that was a long time ago. But it seemed like it was a lot of money, like $25,000 or something like that. And she said, well, I'm going to go out in the courtyard and dance in my nightgown and catch him with my gun and send my grandchildren to college on that money.
Oh, my goodness. So, she was bold.
He was, and, you know, we were all trying to just, you know, get on with life, and you know, try, and I, it wasn't all bad. I had a good life. I had friends. I loved what I was doing at college, and, you know, and my nanny, she didn't make me afraid. She was, you know, very kind and upbeat, and cooked my dinner every night. You know, we had good times, but that was always in the back of your mind, you know. Especially when you went out at night,
right?
You were always, you know, looking around the corner, and like behind the complex, you know, there were places where you could, you know, somebody could have been hiding. He could have been walking around back there looking. You know, you had that in your mind all the time.
Sure, I would think so. Now, did she finish out her life there?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, after she was. You know, got much older and couldn't really live alone anymore. She lived in Calhoun for a while with my parents and then moved into her nursing home, you know, in the last years of her life. But she did stay there. And of course, you know, we all knew later on in, I guess it was 1984 when he was first arrested, that, you know, he was in jail a very long time.
Yeah.
He was convicted in 1986, but they didn't kill him or execute him until 2018. I mean, just think of all that time. There were a lot of appeals and, you know, people brought up questions as to whether his defense was correct. And, you know, so the appeals process just went on and on and on. You know, I couldn't believe that. But he stayed on death row all that time.
Yeah, I've got a lot of mixed feelings about that. And we had a previous episode on Curious Conversations that went into an execution. I don't know if you heard that one or not, but that was someone who was in for a really long time. And you know, there's a lot of stuff with the system, obviously, I don't know about, but it seems kind of strange to me that many years later, it just seems so after the fact, no matter, you know, which side you stand on about capital punishment, it just is very peculiar to me that something can go on as long as it did. But I did understand that there were people who had some questions and maybe even some doubts. What's your thoughts on that?
I feel sure that they got the right guy, you know, especially, I don't know, I was convinced at the time, but now later on, and I've done some research on him, he was a bad guy. He had killed people in other places. He never stopped, you know. He'd do one thing and then he'd do another thing. And I felt sure that it was him. And he even admitted, this was really weird. This came out in his trial. He admitted to being at 6 of the locations where the crimes were committed, but he said he wasn't the guy who killed them. He was just there. It was another guy, you know. I feel sure that it was him.
Well, it's always interesting to me to hear from a criminal like that, their take on it, because I know when, you know, I talked before about inmates that I had written to, and some of their reasoning and some of their, I guess, their answers to questions are peculiar. Like, well, if I killed anybody, I might've killed one. And it's just, that's what one told me. Yeah. And I thought, what if you killed anybody? That's just not the way, you know, quote unquote, normal people talk.
Right. I think one of the reasons why he got away with so much, I've seen pictures of him, you know, when he was young, when they're, you know, at the time they arrested him, he was an attractive guy. I think he even did some modeling and stuff like that. He was very charismatic, you know, got along with people, flirted with women, you know, just, he was supposedly very, very, very attractive to people. Had, you know, and some people can fool you like that, you know. Into thinking that you're safe or whatever.
It's funny that you say that because, I had noticed a lot of his pictures had, when I was writing Richard Ramirez, you know, looking up anything on him, he kind of portrayed himself like a superstar. And this guy kind of had that same, look in his, like a overly confident, hey, I don't know, fill in the blank. He thought, or he has the portrayal in his images that maybe he was, I don't know if he was proud. I don't know if he was, thought he was above the law or, but I will.
He got away with so much. I mean, people said that you get away with murder. Well, he wasn't convicted of all the murders he committed. So I guess you can say he did get away with murder, but he got away with so much. And he did spend some time in jail, you know, here and there, but, yeah, he thought he could just do anything and get away with it.
Yeah, it makes you wonder about societies. You know, this is a whole other thing, but, you know, what does society overlook because they find someone charming? You know, we've seen that a lot with things and even with like cult leaders and just different things where someone has this appeal and this charm that people almost find it hard to think they're capable of something if they present in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I said, you know, we're all looking around, looking at everybody and wondering if is that him? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, he probably wouldn't have been one of the ones you would think that way about, you know, you're thinking of some creepy looking guy or a homeless guy or something like that. And he did not present himself that way. He, you know, he dressed nice and looked nice and, he could probably talk people out of being suspicious of him.
Well, did you know that he had a wife that I guess was stuck by his side till the end? I guess she believed he was innocent.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I thought that was weird. And it's when I was researching a little bit because I knew we were going to talk about this. That's not even one of the first things that came up. So it was almost like an afterthought of what they were looking at, but. Yeah. And then that brings, I always think the loved ones of people like this, it's very interesting, you know, what is their take? Are they just overlooking something? Do they really think they're innocent? Do they love them anyway? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I did a little research too. And like you said, you know, about the playground accident and then his parents were out of the picture and, I think he was kind of passed around, you know, among family. And so there might not have been a close family. I think maybe he had a sibling that lived in Columbus, too. But, you know, I think his early life was just so bad and so random that, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe these were the seeds of what made him the way he was.
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting. All these people that do all these horrible things, it's terrifying and interesting at the same time. And it's, you know, we may never understand. We may try to understand and just never be able to wrap our head around, you know, that mindset. And I'll say that with you and I talking about whether it's possible at all, he was innocent. You know, he had no last words. He had no final statement, no prayer, anything. And I guess, again, this is just thinking from my own head though, and not someone else's, but I'm thinking if I were innocent, man, I think I would go down claiming that as much as I could. Yeah. That would be that final word. But that's to not say he is or isn't or anything. I'm just saying that's where I'm coming from.
I think I read that he purportedly, you know, changed his life while in prison, maybe, you know, got saved or whatever.
Okay.
When you're in jail for that long, you have time to sit and think about your life and what you've done.
Absolutely. And
it's sad that he didn't have a final statement, that he didn't have a, you know, mea culpa, that I'm sorry for what I did. And I think some of the family members of the victims were there to see the lethal injection.
Okay.
You know, couldn't he have made a statement to them or something, you know?
Yeah. You don't know. Of course, you know, I'm the one that, you know, I talk about everything. I can't imagine not saying something my last chance to speak, you know, and right. Maybe that's a statement in itself of, hey, I don't need, if he had made, you know, felt like he was right with God, and maybe he didn't feel like he needed to say anything or thought it would, we don't know. We'll never know that. I guess the main focus here is how this touched you. And, you know, I haven't spoken to anyone who's been in this kind of, personally, that's been in this kind of situation where they were really guarded and concerned for their life and the life of their loved ones. And I appreciate you sharing that with us, because it makes it very personal. You know, personalizes something that's usually held at a distance for most of us.
Right. And you know, the family members are going to be affected, but it affected all of us in the community, you know, and we all just, we felt so bad for the victims and their families. And, you know, they post the pictures on television of the women, and they just, you know, they all kind of reminded me of my grandmother, you know, they
wow.
just seemed like really kind ladies. And, you know, it's just like the most vulnerable, you know, people that could be a victim, you know. And like I said, I knew one of them personally. And so something like this can affect multiple people, not even just the family, but for everyone in the community.
Absolutely. And I, you know, there's no telling how many more stories are out there of someone who knew someone, you know, or lived in the vicinity or found out later. I know I found out crimes later on that someone I actually went to high school committed murder. And, you know, this was not someone I was close to, but that was a double homicide. And you think back and you're thinking, did they act weird in school? Did they, you know,
yeah.
I mean, this was someone I was, that was a good friend of a good friend. And I think, well, I didn't know them directly, but when I talked to them, did they say anything? You know, what happened between here and there?
Right.
You know, so you, if anything ever touches you personally, you can't help but kind of linger on that thought, you know, why and what happened and, you know, just where someone's coming from. But, you know, again, a lot of that we may never know. And I don't even know what happened in that personal situation. I don't know what the outcome was there. That was something I was kind of removed with and didn't hear till later. But, you know, these bizarre things. And I look back on some of the choices that I've made, and I've said this before, and I think, oh my gosh, was I protected during those moments?
And so, I think it draws us all together as human beings. You know, everybody is affected in some way down the line. And, you know, I'm 65. I'm turning 65 tomorrow, by the way.
Oh my gosh. Happy birthday.
Thank you. But this happened when I was 18. And when I was going over this in my mind before our interview, and I got to the part about Ms. Kofor, I cried. You know, it never totally goes away when you're grieving. And I think maybe sometimes we go through this so that we can take care of each other when someone else is grieving for some reason. You know, you think, I know how that feels. mm-hmm. and I can comfort you and understand you and what you're going through. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why we're connected that way.
I think so too. And I appreciate you sharing, and it's a very interesting story, very, very frightening. And, you know, obviously I'm glad you made that out safely. And, you know, I know in hindsight, that's probably.
I retired my can of mace, you know.
There you go. There you go. Well, well, thank you, Terry. And we may have more stories in the future with you, but I appreciate you being on with us.
Well, thanks a lot, Mandy.
Okay. All I can say is, wow, gosh, that is shocking.
Yeah, I mean, so she told me just briefly, you know, before the interview when she first came to me, and but when I heard it all fully like this, I just thought, you picture yourself in that situation and you're thinking you're at these places and you know it could be anybody. You know it could be anybody right there, and you keep thinking, is it going to be me? Is it going to be somebody I know? And then of course, you know, she did have that experience. So, yeah, it's a lot to take in. Of course it would affect you personally.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we've talked about before, is you don't know who you're standing beside, you know, what they've done or what they've been through. So
I know it's a scary thought. It can be overwhelming, and you kind of just like have to not let your brain go there too much.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we want to thank you guys for listening in. And we hope that you will join us next week. We'll be back again on Sunday. Thanks so much.
Well, listen, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, where we post exclusive content, contests, and so much more. And of course, you can keep up with our episodes through Podbean or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And as always, if you have a story that sparks curiosity or you have something that you want us to talk about, just shoot us an email to ourcuriouspodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.